the change management of getting people to embrace a new and different way of doing things is really, really difficult. So now you take the fact that that change, before that would happen, it's like, okay, I'll leave you alone for 2 years and you just kind of figure this out and then we'll do something different in 2 years. Well, now it's like, I'm going to introduce a new tool every 2 weeks. And how on earth do we expect people to keep up and be trained? Over, you know, 3/4 of people in the U.S. have not tried ChatGPT, despite massive media coverage. The majority of people are somewhat sitting on the sidelines and hearing about this, but they're not engaging. Part of that is they don't have enough time, they're scared, they're overwhelmed. There's already too many tools coming at them.
Hello and welcome to Tech for Finance, where we help finance pros stay ahead of the game, develop their skills, and free up time for the things that matter most using technology. Please like and subscribe. Hey everyone, so in this session I had the pleasure of introducing Dave Hartley, who is partner in charge of advisory at Anders CPA & Advisors, who is a technologist turned CPA turned technologist again. So interesting background for you, Dave. But no, it's a pleasure to have you on, as I say. And yeah, looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, Adam, it's great to be here. Since I've connected with you on LinkedIn, I've learned a ton from you. So hopefully I can share a little bit back with you and your audience.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I wanted to kick things off because obviously we had a conversation prior to this session. You said you had some pretty controversial views on remote and hybrid working. And we didn't get too into the weeds. We said we'd save it for the podcast, but now's your opportunity, right? So yeah, over to you. Let's get stuck in.
Yeah, and I don't know how controversial they are. I just have a pretty strong point of view on certain things. And I have been interested by the whole return to office mandate that's happened over the last really 12 months or so. And, you know, from my perspective, I think remote and hybrid work are definitely here to stay. So you can force people back to the office, but I don't think that's a permanent solution. So I think that's going to be a real issue. And I think as a result of people being forced to come back to the office, I think sort of the shuffle that we've seen since the pandemic is going to continue. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One is I think a lot of people that were forced into remote work aren't really good at it. They're not disciplined enough. There's a lot of distractions at home. It's easy to just pop on the TV or I've got to do laundry or whatever. So a lot of people really aren't good at remote work. But they're not self-aware enough to realize that's going to hold them back on their career. So I think you've got that to sort itself out. I think the people that are forced back to the office are going to say, I don't know that this is for me. I think you've got just so many of these factors going on. And the other part is that companies aren't really good at remote work. A lot of them embraced remote work because they had to, and now they either want to force people back or they're trying to figure out, okay, does this really work? And are we really committed to it? And so as a result of that, they haven't really done the things that they need to do to make a great employee experience for remote employees.
And some of the notes that you sent through, so thanks for doing that. You gave me a lots of prep, so you know, all good. So part of what you're saying is it's a good idea to be intentional. Yeah, so don't just expect that everybody can just be plonked at a desk at home and you know, expect them to work in the same way as they would in the office. So you talk about design there, you know, maybe the potential for retreats and that sort of stuff. So I don't know whether you want to dig into a little bit more about what you mean by designing that sort of working environment.
Yeah, I think a lot of companies, a lot of business leaders got forced into remote work as a result of the pandemic. And I think, you know, if your company decides that remote work is not for you, that's okay. There are pros and cons with each of the models. And if your business strategy is, we're going to have everybody in the office because we can find the employees that we need in our local geography, and that's going to work for us, okay, that's fine. But that's an intentional decision that you've made. If you're going to embrace remote work, you also need to be intentional about that. And when you do that, you need to recognize that that's a different experience than people coming into an office every day. And so as a result of that, yeah, you mentioned a couple of things like, you know, if you have remote employees, to prevent turnover and to keep them engaged, you've got to think about things like in-person retreats. So one of the things that we do at Anders is we get people together in our virtual CFO practice, which has a lot of remote employees in it. We get together every 6 months. And the focus of that retreat is not on technical training. It's not on, you know, doing a bunch of updates on the company or the firm. It's really about relationships. It's about people getting connected, getting bonded. Because what we found is that 6 months, you know, that's when people can start to drift. And if you get everybody back together every 6 months, that helps a lot. You know, another example is how many of you are in a hybrid work environment where you come into a conference room and there's one or two people hanging on the monitor on the wall? And for those people, that is a horrible experience. If you've got eight people in a conference room, the meeting is really with the eight people. As much as you try to involve the people that are on the screen, it's really hard to do unless it's actively managed. So one of the things that you have to decide is that what you want, or would you prefer that everybody have the same experience? So everybody that's in the office go back to their workstations and join the same way as the remote employees. And that way everybody's on an even level in terms of being able to contribute. Those are the types of things that I'm talking about in terms of being intentional about those decisions. And then when you decide that, then the second part of that is once you've designed it, then you have to be disciplined about following with it. Because I talk to a lot of companies, they're like, yeah, we had great intentions, but we were going to do that, but we really don't do that anymore. And, you know, it's just easy to slip back into old habits that, you know, prior to the pandemic for a lot of companies existed for a long, long time. So those things, being intentional, and then once you do decide what you want to be, being very disciplined about execution on that, I think that's really great. That's important for a really strong remote employee experience.
And it's interesting hearing you talk through that, because I think you're dead right. And I love the example of having an employee hanging on the wall, almost as if they're for show, right? Thanks for that image. Now that I'm thinking about that, I can think of numerous meetings where people have literally just been hanging on the wall. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe from my personal perspective, I don't mind so much dialing into the office, but I suppose technology helps us there because it's a new office, right? And it's not just a case of hanging on the wall. I mean, we're talking like big monitors with all of, you know, the clever Logitech cameras that follow people around the room and that sort of stuff. But previous conversation with Mike Manilak at Google, who obviously works in a hybrid environment, he's doing some innovative stuff around sort of whiteboarding and obviously drawing as part of those remote sessions as a means of increasing that engagement. But I think it's an interesting premise, designing that working environment. And do we get to the point where we define the best meeting formats based on the goal of that meeting? Mm-hmm. So do we say, for this type of meeting, everyone's in the office? For this type of meeting, mm-hmm. everyone's remote? And I don't know how easy that is to enforce, but I would kind of agree with what you're saying is, you know, if everybody's working consistently, i.e. all remote or all in person, mm-hmm. people do 100% feel part of the discussion as opposed to left out. I've not really thought of it in those terms before, but I suppose there's some logic in that, right?
Yep. Yeah. And I think an example of that would be, so our virtual CFO, I'd mentioned the virtual CFO practice has every 6 months we have a retreat. Well, the first 2 days of that, before the retreat, the leadership team gets together in person. And we work very well remotely. We meet all the time through Teams, have lots of interactions, you know, weekly meetings, those types of things. But there's something to be said for meeting in person. And so I think even though that's a largely remote practice and we really embrace remote work, in-person interaction and relationships is absolutely key. So I think, you know, similar to the point I made earlier about, you know, we don't have these retreats and do technical trainings because that's the thing that can be done really well, just remotely, individually. It's more about relationships and collaboration and those types of things. So I think that's really the next level of maturity for remote work, which is more and more employees being intentional and specific about, yeah, when we do this, these are the tools that we use to communicate. These are the expectations for these types of meetings. Here's what we do. And these types of meetings will be in person. I think all of that is sort of the next iteration that we're going to see evolve, because like I said earlier, right now, the remote employee experience for a huge amount of remote employees is really, really bad. And I think those employees are going to opt to move and do something different. Companies are going to have to get better at this and get serious about it and become more intentional about it. So I think that's all going to be coming up in the next couple of years.
Do we think that there's a generational gap as well? And maybe casting a mind to the future. So I think about my kids, and I've spoken about them before. You know, so I've got a 3.5-year-old and a little one that's just coming up to 2, right? And they live a lot of time on their iPads. You know, the governance element of that is I'll block channels that are garbage because there is a lot of garbage on YouTube. Mm-hmm. Very difficult to enforce the screen time limits, especially when you want them to, you know, quieting down so we can actually have a peaceful dinner, you know, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking about them because they'll grow up with the tech, you know, and there's a good chance that the majority of their work might be in some sort of augmented reality scenario. So I totally hear what you're saying. And yeah, I'm with you. My personal preference is to say, look, you can't beat human to human interaction. But for the younger generation, I mean, if they've got the tech and they do feel like they're included, are they going to care whether they're remote or in an office or not? Mm-hmm.
And I do think that will be sort of the next evolution as more and more, as more generations are introduced to the workforce. I think you are going to see that start to shift over time. But I do think that's one of the things I think we should talk about a minute, which is that, you know, for me, so I've been in the CPA profession for over 3 decades now. And what's interesting is I think one of the things that I think business leaders can excel at is when they recognize what they're good at and what they're not good at. And what's interesting to me is when I look at a situation, I solve a problem a particular way. And when I engage our team members who are just out of college, they think very differently about how to solve that problem. And they come up with solutions I never would have thought of. And I think that's one of the things that is figuring out how to tap into that expertise, I think, is really important, because that is, it's a whole different way of problem solving. And that's one of the things, that's one of the issues I think that exists with AI, is that for most people, it solves problems they didn't know they had, because we're all doing our lives and we're doing things the way that we do. And without these technologies, we would just keep doing that. The opportunity is that there's a much better way to do it. And that's what a lot of the AI tools are going to bring us, are better ways for us to do things or eliminate tasks that we're doing today that we don't need to do in the future. So I think all that kind of plays together. And as we watch future generations start to come in, I think we're going to continue to see that shift and evolve.
It reminds me of an interesting discussion that I saw, kind of loosely related. I think it was a Reddit thread or something like that. And they were probably an engineer or a developer or something like that. And they just posed a question that was like, has anybody like managed to essentially like do their entire job with AI? Like, am I the only one that's basically not working anymore because AI is doing it all for me? You know, and I think that's something we need to be mindful as well, because it's about getting balance, because there's a traditional mindset that says, you know, senior leadership level, you know, we want people in the office so that we can see what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm not saying it's the right move. For me, the benefits of being in an office is to absorb, to learn, you know, especially for junior members of the team, you know, if they're in sponge mode and they want to learn from their peers, then being sat next to them is quite useful. But I think it does prompt an interesting thought process relating to governance in how far do we want to take it, you know, and maybe that will be okay. So to my kids, you know, if they are masters of the tools, you know, are we looking at people that are tools experts, you know, rather than actually having to do the doing? Do you see what I mean? Are you looking for the people that are best equipped to tell the tools what to do? You know, because in reality, there's going to be less need for the doing. I don't know whether I'm making any sense. I'm kind of speaking out loud as I go. You hear what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the expectations are going to change, because I think now, and even, you know, historically, the CPA profession has been largely driven by hours. And now you think about, okay, and so part of why I think AI is what's going to finally kill the chargeable hour in the CPA world and a lot of professions is because for how many decades, it's been a reasonable approximation of value created. So I can look at something and say, yeah, that probably took 8 to 10 hours to put together, and then I'm going to charge you based on that. I think in the future, what do we do if somebody is able to do their job in 4 hours or 16 hours and not work an entire work week? I think that's going to be interesting, because it's like, should we punish the people that know how to use these tools and have figured this out, and it, versus just putting in and doing a lot of the work as you described? I think that'll be an interesting balance to watch, as basically it becomes more an orchestrator type role as opposed to some, you know, to people actually doing the work.
I think we need to be focusing on what some companies have already done, which is the results only work environment, which is essentially like, I don't care about the working out, providing the quality of the output is high enough. Mm-hmm. We've had discussions on the show before about, you know, would that stack up in an audit, especially when we talk about finance? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes we need to see the working out, you know, whether it be from an accuracy perspective, whether it be from a security perspective, whether it be from a risk perspective. So I can see the reluctance just to say, oh yeah, you know, don't care how you do your job, providing you meet these KPIs. Mm-hmm. But I think there's definitely a gray area in terms of governance and risk that mm-hmm. needs to be addressed. And I don't know how we do that. And I'll use an example, right? And I'm seeing a shift here. So I use Upwork. Yeah. So mm-hmm. so at the moment I'm a business of one around my day job. So I need to find shortcuts to find the time. You know, mm-hmm. so I have to admit that I cannot do everything myself. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to copying and pasting data, you know, uploading, so you know, all of that sort of stuff that you know, I can just have somebody do overnight. That's really useful. But the way that Upwork works, which is really attractive, comes out back to what you're saying about the chargeable hour, is if you contract with somebody on Upwork and you say, right, well, I'll set my limit at 5 hours, 10 hours a week or whatever, when they are working for you, Upwork records them as they do the work. So you as a customer can at any point go and see exactly what they were doing during the time that they were charging you for those hours. Mm-hmm. Now, I appreciate a lot of contractors on Upwork might not want to be recorded using AI to produce outputs, which mm-hmm. I totally get. And I think that's leading to a bit of a shift whereby some of these subcontractors are wanting to move away from Upwork. So I've seen a shift recently of people seeing your job post on Upwork and then sending you a separate email mm-hmm. to say, saw your post on Upwork, can we have a conversation? I think Upwork have also upped their rates in terms of what they take off the contractors as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out as well, you know, because I've got a feeling that more contractors won't necessarily want to work on an hourly rate, or at least mm-hmm. they want to be finding times that they can squeeze more into that hour while still proving their value. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know where I was going with that, but it loosely relates to maybe people not wanting Big Brother watching all the time. And then the wider question is, you know, as I said previously, does it matter if the quality of the work is good enough?
Yeah. And I think there are a lot of things like that that we're still processing and embracing. You know, for most organizations, remote work is only 4 years old. So, you know, it's like, okay, so we're like infants when it comes to dealing with remote work. And I think, you know, what you just outlined, sort of the convergence of remote work and all the things that are happening with technology and AI, both those forces coming together, I think we have to reckon with that sort of, you know, and I remember, you know, pre-internet days. And so I think about, you know, just how much the world has changed, how much professionally what I do, what my team does compared to what we did when I entered the profession, and it's substantially different. And that's happened over a 30 plus year period. I think now when you look at what's going to happen in the next 3 years, the next 5 years, the next 10 years, I think there's going to be significant amounts of change. And I think all these forces are going to be hard for us to grapple with. And it is going to create a lot of issues that we're going to have to wrestle with, you know, fortunately, my take on this is it'll be more opportunities and there'll be a lot more upside, but there are going to be challenges that we're going to have to work through.
Is it too fast? Because I'm looking at your notes here from some of the topics you suggested. Because on the one hand, you're saying, you know, over 75% of Americans haven't even tried ChatGPT. You know, and a lot of finance pros are frustrated that their companies aren't driving, you know, AI and technology adoption in the way that they want to as an employee. Mm-hmm. But as I mentioned on some of the previous podcasts, you spend 6 months implementing something, and then in 6 months, the tech is going to be drastically different and infinitely more capable than what it's capable of now. Mm-hmm. So is the tech moving at a rate that's too fast for us to be able to match that with our rate of adoption and governance?
Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great question. And I think in some cases, the answer to that is, yeah, it's probably too much. And when you think about, you know, businesses don't change overnight. And when you think about how we got to where we are today, a lot of times in most organizations, you know, there's decades of sort of all of these things have happened that have gotten the organization to where they're at today. And you can't just forget all of that history. And for most organizations, they're big ships and they move slowly. Even if you're a smaller organization, generally there's a lot of historical things that have come along the way. And frankly, that's one of the things I enjoy about my job the most. When I work with companies, small to mid-sized companies, every one of them is different. And when you start peeling the onion, you find out, oh, well, 7 years ago this happened and 12 years ago this happened. And all of that leads to where the maturity of the organization is today. And I find that fascinating because every story has the human element of sort of how we got to where we are today. But I think a lot of those types of issues, there's going to be a lot of forces, a lot of change, and a lot of questions that I don't know that we know the answer to today. And we are going to have to figure those things out going forward.
It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's one of the things for me that is the most exciting about this is that there is a lot of unknowns. And, you know, I just heard, you know, last week another, you know, fourth industrial revolution comment was made about some of these things that are happening in AI tools that are coming out now. And I do think it's going to have a significant impact. But I scratch my head a lot and think about, and Adam, I know you look at a ton of tools and you're seeing firsthand how quickly this is evolving and the new capabilities and the new functionality that's coming. You know, I'm in the CPA world and we were bragging about a year ago that ChatGPT could not pass the CPA exam. So we pounded our chest and said, yes, CPAs are unique. And then 3 weeks later, it passed. ChatGPT passed the CPA exam. Of course, you know, restrictions, limitations, all that kind of stuff. But conceptually, that evolution is happening at an extraordinarily rapid pace. And the change management aspect of both us as humans and as businesses to change and evolve as rapidly as these tools are evolving, it's just not the same. We as humans can't keep pace and businesses cannot change quickly enough. So, you know, it's also interesting when you think about, well, who's the winners and losers as part of this? How much are the companies now that are investing hundreds of millions of dollars into building a lot of their own tech? Is that going to create a competitive advantage for them? Or will the fast followers be able to get basically a lot of the same benefits without having to have made those investments? So I think that's another, you know, thing to watch in terms of who am I going to bet on in the future? And how should I place my bets? Which organization do I want to work for? Do I want to be a part of? You know, how progressive do we want to be? How much should we be spending investing in this versus more taking a wait and see attitude to avoid building up a bunch of technical debt that we're just going to have to change out every 6, 12, 18 months?
And to liken that to a scenario that some of the listeners may have gone through. So if you work with, I know you and I, Dave, have got a lot of experience in the obviously small to medium enterprise space, right? But some larger organizations may go through big tech transformation initiatives, whether it's like an SAP or an Oracle, or, you know, one of those sort of fundamental changes in business systems that could take 12, 18, 24 months to implement. Mm-hmm. The problem is, And it's not just a tech challenge either. Because if you take a long implementation time frame with something like an ERP system, your business is going to have different people and is going to work in a different way 6 to 12 months into that large implementation than it did when you first started the project. Mm-hmm. So there is almost this consistent change management, change request process that goes on. So you're trying to implement whilst re-implementing change that goes on as part of the project. And that's my fear with some of these AI change initiatives. But it's compounded by the fact that, you know, with a traditional type SAP system, the tech's probably not going to evolve too much. There might be a couple of, you know, releases in the time that you're implementing the project, but the majority of the issue is business change, not technology change. My fear with AI is that not only have you got business change, but you've got rapid tech change at the same time. So you as a business decide that you're going to spend $500,000, $1 million, whatever that figure is, on, you know, spreading AI throughout the org, whether it's, you know, OpenAI hosted on Azure and you've got development resource that training your own model on your data and all that sort of stuff. And then in 6 months, you've got the next model, the OpenAI release, that supersedes and almost makes all of that work redundant. Mm-hmm. So how, and there's no answer to this question, unfortunately, at the moment. It's how do we prepare for that? Do we just wait? Do we just say, right, well, there's no point in us implementing anything now because I know in 6 months the tools are just going to be like 10 times, like 100x better than they are at the moment. Mm-hmm. But we need to do something, right?
Yeah, and I think that's a, you know, I'm old enough to remember the go-go days of ERP in the 90s. And, you know, the reason that worked then is because you implemented solutions that basically worked for a decade. And so you did some minor enhancements and upgrades, but you probably remember, and you still see it today, those are really, really hard. And we've been doing them for 30 years. And now when you think about your question, how are you going to do it today when things are changing so quickly? And I think and it's a great question. And that kind of goes to my, how much should we spend today versus should we be a fast follower? I think there's a lot of business strategy that's going to be involved in that. And some of your listeners may not know that I actually led technology for a public company as a CIO. And I led some major change implementations like that. Well, we did swap out some major wholesale systems, learned a lot along the way, and can tell you those are really painful. Because the biggest obstacle of that is the human aspect. The change management of getting people to embrace a new and different way of doing things is really, really difficult. So now you take the fact that change, before that would happen, it's like, okay, I'll leave you alone for 2 years and you just kind of figure this out and then we'll do something different in 2 years. Well, now it's like, I'm going to introduce a new tool every 2 weeks. And how on earth do we expect people to keep up and be trained and not just run away, because we're throwing too much change, especially non-technology people that, you know, and over, you know, 3/4 of people in the US have not tried ChatGPT despite massive media coverage. So that tells you a little bit about there's a whole bunch of people. The majority of people are somewhat sitting on the sidelines and hearing about this, but they're not engaging. Part of that is they don't have enough time. They're scared. They're overwhelmed. There's already too many tools coming at them. And I'm a technology guy. I love technology. But when my firm rolls out another tool, it's like, wow, I don't know. I get it that it's good and I understand strategically why it matters. But man, for me as a human to learn yet another tool is really hard to do. And I think that's going to be a significant challenge. That this whole pacing and change management and the human aspect of this is going to be a major obstacle, but also interesting to see who figures it out and who does it better than others, because I think that's going to result in huge competitive advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but again, it's finding that balance, isn't it? Because, you know, you don't want to invest, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars to gain that competitive advantage and then find that your competitor 6 months can take an off-the-shelf tool to achieve the same ends. Yep. Do you see what I mean?
So, yep. So yeah, on a monthly subscription, you know, it is like that is completely possible. But I do, Adam, like, you know, sort of your shift and some of the things I've seen in your work, your focus on Friday frameworks and those types of things. I think that's a lot of, you've got to figure out the strategy, you've got to have the frameworks, and you've got to recognize and build that into your process that basically the tools are going to change and they're going to get better. But there's a lot of things around process and just design that are really important for people to understand the fundamentals. And then it makes it easier to swap out the tools because you've got that underlying infrastructure in place. But for a lot of organizations, they're more approaching this on an ad hoc basis and just slapping in tools here and there, as opposed to this being a well thought out strategy roadmap kind of exercise, which is, you know, in my opinion, is what's needed for this to be truly cost effective.
Really quick, guys, as you know, I don't run ads and I no longer sell anything on here. So to help me, it'd be great if you could share with just one other person, leave a review, give a thumbs up and subscribe. It really does make a difference. Now back to the show.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of having a framework. You know, what is the methodology that we can apply to, you know, tech change or, you know, whatever the category of solution or outcome you're looking to achieve is. But, you know, we only have frameworks at the moment for stuff that we know exists, you know, and that's where things fall down a little bit, you know. So I'd love to start writing more about autonomy in terms of what, you know, some of these agents can do. We mentioned Devin, which is the development bot that will basically prompt itself to write code. You know, you don't actually need a user anymore, it just gets on and does it itself, right? You know, and I'd love to do that sort of stuff, but unfortunately I'm not classed as an AI guru, so I don't have early access to any of these tools. Not a, like, major scale AI guru anyway. But either way, you know, when that technology is available, it will still come down to a framework. Because as I've said previously, right, okay, well, you've got an AI that can work autonomously to do a task. Right? Well, you've still got to set it the task. Mm-hmm. You know, you've still got to design what you want the outcome to be, to use your terminology. So the framework there is, okay, well, how do we use it? You know, how do we set ourselves up for success? How do we govern it? Yeah, and then how do we ensure that it's a successful, you know, secure and all of that sort of stuff. But I wanted to come back to the point that you made earlier about tool overwhelm, mm-hmm. you know, whereby you said, you know, you've worked in tech and on tech initiatives, and it's hard to keep up with the rate of change sometimes. Mm-hmm. I read a Gartner study recently that said, I think it's like almost 40% of knowledge workers say that they struggle to find information because of, what did they describe it as? It was like application, something where basically the fundamental premise was, because there was that many applications within the organization, mm-hmm. there was no clear path to finding the information that they wanted. And again, that, you know, that could be a use case for AI, right? It doesn't matter where the information is if you can just chat to a bot and it tells you where it is.
Yep, it goes and pulls it for you, yep.
But I think in a related article, there was also a stat that said something, I can't remember whether it was 50, I don't think it was quite as much as 60, but it said something, basically a large percentage of CFOs were saying they don't think that they're seeing the return from their tech investment mm-hmm. that they'd want. Which again, for me, prompts an interesting chain of thought, which is, okay, well, if you're not seeing the return from the existing tech, how is adding more tech going to resolve that issue? Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe it's a trade-off, right? So you say, okay, well, we've not seen the return from that tech, so we're going to scrap it. We're going to retire it. You know, difficult for tech that's, you know, had a ton of investment, right? You know, you don't want to spend $100,000 on a project and say, oh, it's not worked. Like, let's give up.
Let's go to the next thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. But yeah, I think what I'm getting to here is, it's that bright, shiny lights thing, right? It's, mm-hmm. you know, yes, I think it is a fundamental shift. So I think everybody needs a base knowledge in how these tools work. They need to have used them in some sort of capacity so that they understand the use cases, you know, they understand the advantages. But there's no harm in saying, right, well, yeah, we're using it a little bit. It's improved my personal productivity by X percent. But actually, you know, it's probably a better usage of our time to make sure that we are getting the most possible value from our existing tech before we then add on more. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you've seen that or whether you've got any guidance around that. But I think it's a missed opportunity. You know, don't just add, you know, try and optimize and make best of.
Yeah. And I consider myself a business technologist, which is technology is great. But primarily for me, it's about achieving a business outcome. And technology is a way to be able to get there. And definitely during my CIO days, one of the things I preached is benefits realization. Because a lot of times, and we've got a pretty poor track record over the last couple of decades of, you know, and especially tech vendors will make a lot of promises about what their product will do. And then as we all know through implementation, maybe you get, you know, 20% of that, 40% of that, 60% of that, but you generally don't get all the benefits that were promised as part of the initial pitch. And I think that really stepping back and thinking about challenging the spend and really figuring out, are we getting the, you know, the return on the investment that we expected from this? And I think as tech professionals, we need to be the ones that go forward and say, hey, here's what we thought it would do. Here's what it's actually doing. Here's the shortcomings. And then here's what we're going to do about it. Because I think that's one of the things, and finance folks have probably heard this story a lot, you know, it's like, well, it didn't quite do whatever, but there are so-and-so reasons, but you never really get a clear answer as to what's actually happening and what we're going to do about it. And I think for the tech professionals that can actually come forward with that and basically say, hey, I'm going to tell you exactly what happened, and it didn't go the way it was planned, but here's what we learned, and here's what we're going to do differently. Here's what the next iteration is. And Adam, I think to your point, I think what happens a lot of times is that people do just keep slapping on tools and try, and you know, in some ways, maybe it's conscious, maybe it's subconscious, trying to cover a little bit of some of the things of how we got here. And so we'll just add another tool and continuing to extend the tech stack. And at the end of the day, you're right, to your point, it's going to get extremely cumbersome. It's going to get sloppy. Because it's not, there's not a strategy behind it. It's not really defined what the business objectives are. And I think a lot of those things are going to inhibit organizations going forward. And I'm really interested to see what technical debt comes out of this. Like people are, the investments that people are making now, how are they going to maintain those going forward? Do they have a plan? And you said earlier, a lot of this is unknown. Do they really know how this is, do they have a plan for as the technology changes, how they're going to evolve with it? And I think in some cases you do, I think in other cases you don't. And I think that's really going to play itself out over the next couple of years.
Yeah, and it's how far you want to take it. And I appreciate your breakdown there of how you, you know, how you look objectively at that tech piece, you know, so why hasn't it worked? Let's break this down. And I think a lot of people don't go through that process. Maybe because, especially if they've got if they're invested in it, either because they generated the business case or they pushed it and they were a firm advocate of it, maybe there's a reluctance to, you know, say, oh, that hasn't quite worked, because, you know, your neck's on the block sometimes, isn't it? You know, it's sometimes difficult to, you know, be transparent, especially when you've advocated for a project. But the reason I say is, you know, how far do you take it is in line with what we discussed when we said, you know, do we just wait for a while? Because there are some things that we can take as fact. New iterations of the technology you're already using will come out of the woodwork. So we've seen Microsoft Copilot. Yeah. I've had mixed feedback on that. Don't know whether you've used it. Mm-hmm. But especially from a finance perspective, people are underwhelmed by it because there was this massive marketing hype around it. You know, yeah, you've got your own sort of personal assistant in office and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And anybody who's got sort of a basic to intermediate understanding of the way that Excel works has found that, you know, Copilot in Excel just doesn't meet expectations, right? But that to one side. The point is, it's in there now and it will only get better over time. Yep. So that's one thing that we can take as a given, yeah? Your tech stack at the moment will evolve, unless you're using a legacy application whereby you've only got a version of Office on your laptop that you've installed from a physical disk, right? But that's, you know, that's probably in a minority if you're in that situation right now, right? So that's number one. Number two is there is a fundamental shift in the way that we need to work, yeah? And this is not a sort of bury your head in the sand moment. This is a, you know, either get used to it or suffer as a result. Yeah, so I think the takeaway there is learn. Yeah, even if there's fear. And to go back to your point there about 75% of Americans not using ChatGPT, I think it does relate to that fear element, you know, because people don't want to accept there is that level of intelligence in something that isn't them. And that's ignoring the job risk. Yeah, that goes past job risk or being replaced. I'd say that's more at a fundamental level to say, I'm scared of, you know, that level of intelligence, full stop. So, yeah, but I'm going to start rambling, Dave, so I'll let you take over. Don't know whether you've got anything to add.
No, I would say, so I do think, you know, I think there's lots of reasons for why people have avoided it to this point. I think part of it is also we've lived our lives for a long time and we've been able to survive without it. So it's kind of this, you know, and even myself, I have to stop myself and think about, wait a minute, could I use Copilot for this? Could I use ChatGPT for this? So it's a discipline that you have to change in your behaviors in terms of how you go after, you know, and attack some of this stuff. But I think that's really when it becomes real. And I think the sort of the tipping point is as more and more of these capabilities get introduced into the business tools that we already use today. And like Copilot, I'll be doing something and it'll pop up and say, hey, I can do this, I can do that. That I think is going to be a huge shift, because that's when it's in people's faces and they can't ignore it anymore, because it's right there in the thing that they do every day. And I think at that point, we're going to see a lot more acceptance, a lot more adoption. And I do think you made the point that you do have to be, you have to educate yourself on this stuff. And you have to figure out, you know, and for leaders, any leaders, which basically is everybody listening, is basically you have to get out there, you have to learn, and then share what you've learned, and then get other people engaged in the discussion and the dialogue. What did you learn? What are the things that you're doing? And given, you know, most organizations have multi-generational, diverse workforce, and so you're going to see different people embrace different things. You know, one of the easiest things, I think, from my perspective, is some of the AI note takers that are out there. Because that's a real easy thing that you can do, is just starts getting invited to meetings, and then you start to see these amazing summaries and different things that these technologies can do. So that's kind of an easy way to get started. So, you know, put up the guardrails, have the discussions, but then, you know, part of learning is failure, and you have to try things, and they're not all going to work, but that's how you learn. And I think you just have to be part of an organization that's willing to take the risk to try. And then when things don't work out, what did we learn from it? And how are we going to do better going forward? And I think part of that learning journey is going to be key for organizations to instill in their entire workforce, so that people feel comfortable taking risks and feel comfortable trying things that are different and are not punished when something doesn't work out exactly the way that, you know, it was supposed to work out. Because that's what happens. Anybody that's in technology knows that that's all too common. But that's what you've got to do to be able to move organizations forward and to get people on board with the change, as opposed to just forcing it down their throats.
I think that was well said. The only thing that I'd add to that is to set clear boundaries. Because in my discussions, I hear a lot about people wanting to understand use cases, wanting to let the team loose on the tools, you know, and wanting to your point earlier, get that competitive edge to increase efficiency, productivity, and so on and so forth. But I think every organization, this isn't just limited to finance, even though it could be argued that finance is more important because you're dealing with, you know, core business information, i.e. company financials, is to get that base level of governance in place that says, we're not going to stop anybody from using the tools if they want to. Yeah, because if somebody wants to use a tool, they'll find a way of doing it. You know, whether it's on a personal device that isn't plugged into the company infrastructure or whatever. If somebody wants to use something bad enough, they'll do it. Yeah. So, you know, don't take it that just because your company policy blocks a URL means that they're still not able to use a similar tool in some format. And a simple example of that is you might block ChatGPT. Yeah, somebody can still go copilot.microsoft.com, which is a legitimate URL. Obviously, it's got Microsoft in it. Yeah, then you have to block copilot.microsoft.com. Yeah, and then your team find out that actually you can access all of these large language models using something like Poe, mm-hmm. poe.com, mm-hmm. yeah, which is another URL you've got to block. So mm-hmm. I think just get that out of your minds to say that we're going to stop people using AI, because I think they'll find a way around it. The next thing is to say, fine, happy for you to use the tools, but these are the boundaries. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do not, under any circumstances, feed sensitive information into an AI. Unless the business is validated to say that we're using ChatGPT Team, we're using ChatGPT Enterprise, or some of the paid versions of Claude, mm-hmm. because then you've got the SOC 2 compliance, you've got all of the other policies, the ISOs, all of that sort of stuff to say, right, fine, you know, we've done our due diligence and it's secure. But secondly to that, once you get past the security piece, it's the, what do we want people to be able to do or produce with the AI that we are comfortable in doing it? And if it was me, so using the example of Copilot in Outlook, you can use Copilot to create an email. Mm-hmm. I would nip that in the bud straight away. That's just my personal feeling, and I feel strongly about it. Mm-hmm. I am fundamentally against people using AI to create emails and pressing send. Yeah, I think it defeats the point of, you know, having a conversation, or, you know, having a voice, because it's not our voice anymore. Yeah, it's AI's voice. Yeah, by all means, if you want to use the coaching feature, you know, is this going to come across in the right way? Then fine, get the tips and the tidbits or whatever. But always make sure that you've acted as the editor, and it is your words and it is your voice. So that would be just me. My policy is just, you know, make sure that you have that. But then, what's the next iteration of that? So if we've sorted the security piece and we're doing some data analysis, you know, or we're producing some visuals using like a Jupyter Notebook, Google Colab or something like that, are you happy for that to be done? What's the risk in it producing incorrect data? What's the validation process going to be? Do we need to see the working out that we discussed earlier? Does it need an approver? Yeah, do we need to go to that state when we say, right, well, yeah, we're speeding up our workflow with AI, but we still need somebody mm-hmm. to validate, and we still need somebody to sign on the dotted lines and say, yes, this output that's generated from AI by this individual has been sanity checked and validated by this person, mm-hmm. and we're happy with it. And I think that is fundamental. Everybody needs at least a one page categorized into sections of the do's and don'ts and what you are comfortable in letting your team do with AI, because otherwise it could get out of control and it poses quite a big risk to the organization. So sorry, yeah. I've thrown a lot at you again.
Well, I think the point of, you know, there's got to be a human at the end that takes responsibility for it. I think we all heard there was the lawsuit or the lawyer that used ChatGPT and it came up with fake cases that were cited and that, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I think that's the risk for all of us, is that at the end of the day, there has to be a human that's responsible for whatever that output is. So I think that's a great point. I think defining the rules of the road is absolutely critical. I think the security aspects, that's actually one of the main barriers I see. Change management and security are a couple of the main barriers to adoption in small to mid-sized companies, because people start doing things and then all of a sudden they realize, oh, wait a minute, you mean it can get access to that data? It can go pull this, it can pull that. And then you have people that start to freak out and say, well, stop it. We're not doing anything until we figure this out. So that is sort of one of the stages of evolution, I think, in companies figuring out how to do this. But the other point that I would make is also, you know, as part of all of that, there are a ton of assumptions built into models and built into these technologies, that there has to be either a recognition of those assumptions and sort of a human validating that those assumptions are, you know, what they should be, or at least an understanding that sort of how this came to be. And that goes back to our conversation around sort of just looking at the end result or looking at the process of how we got there. And I think understanding the assumptions, the pieces that went into it, that's part of what the human needs to do to make sure the technology is delivering as we would expect it to and as we need it to produce work for our clients or for our organization or whatever.
Yeah. It comes with its own difficulties as well, right? Because it could be argued that you can increase your output. You know, so instead of me being able to generate, you know, five documents, five visuals, whatever, I can double that. Mm-hmm. If we're now saying that in using these tools, the level of trust has gone down a little bit, you know, whoever the approver is, has just doubled their workload in approvals because the output has increased. So that's something to consider. I mean, thinking out loud, there are probably some things that are easier to validate than others. So if we take mathematics, the models are now a lot better than they used to be. I remember when you used to try and do a complex equation with some of the original large language models, like it either produced just downright wrong answers, or they'd be close but not quite. Yeah, I've done a lot of research on the new models and got them to carry out complex equations. And the good news is they're pretty much at the point now where, you know, there's the right answer most times, either because they're using some sort of Python calculation in the background to validate, or they use a mixture of experts models that basically validates itself in producing the output. I don't know the technical side of it. But the difficulty comes if there's an element of variability, you know, and an element of interpretation, you know. So when we look at, you know, sort of I guess financial forecasting, or, you know, stuff where there's a decision point. So I guess the question to ask yourself is, are we happy that this is correct enough to be able to make a crucial business decision off the back of it? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is no, revert to the traditional way of doing it, you know, because otherwise it just poses too much risk, right?
Yeah, and I think as soon as we get comfortable with that, then it's going to evolve and change. So, you know, you've gotten to the point where with these models, you're now at a point of comfort, but, you know, then it comes back to, well, but is my point of view the same as your point of view in terms of what comfort level is acceptable? And so, you know, a lot of these things are going to be, and then what happens when something goes wrong? Sort of how, well, I thought it achieved the threshold. Well, you know, I disagree. So there's going to be all sorts of interesting things like that start to play out, decisions that have to be made. And I think as business leaders, one of the things we have to do is really, you know, make sure the conversation is happening and that you've got the right people talking about the right issues so that we understand how decisions are being made, what the risk is. Are we cognizant of the risk? Do we understand that if this happens, then, you know, this negative consequence occurs? All of those things, you want to make sure that those things are happening. And even if you're an individual contributor, if you can be part of having that thought process and then educating other people about, here's what I did, and here are the things that I think could go wrong, but here are the things that are out there. And then to have people with different experiences, more experience, give you feedback on that. Hey, well, you forgot about this, you forgot about that. You know, a lot of those things are how, as individual professionals, we're all going to grow. But then as organizations, sort of defining that, because, yeah, to go back to our earlier conversation, the technologies are going to continue to change and they're going to continue to evolve. And there will constantly be new capabilities. And if we have sort of an agreement on what that is going to look like, a process that we're going to follow, a framework that we're going to use, that's how, at the end of the day, we're going to be able to make better decisions organizationally with some consistency going forward.
I think that's really well summarized, Dave. So, I mean, we're on the hour. I've got screaming kids in the background, so we might have to wrap up there. Mm-hmm. But I'll ask you the same question that I ask all of my guests, and this wasn't in the prep because I like to surprise people.
Okay.
The podcast called Tech for Finance, right? You know, and I come from a place of experimenting with just about every type of productivity app that you can conceive of. You know, if there was a new tool or a new app for that, then it would be me that would be downloading, like, you know, three different versions of it and playing with all of them, you know, just because I'm a bit of a nerd like that, right? Mm-hmm. But the question is, do you have a tool, and it could be a browser extension, it could be an app on your phone, it could be a desktop application or a piece of software that you literally couldn't live without? You can't say ChatGPT, and you can't say Notion, because we had that response like five times in a row.
Got it.
So over to you. What couldn't you live without? It could be personal or professional.
Yeah, and actually for me, and so I'll take the business route on this, I would say for me, it's Copilot. And the reason why it's Copilot is not only for my use, but then also I have to get hundreds of people also using this tool. So if I'm able to learn things on it and then share what I learn in a tool that I know they have access to, then I think that's how we're going to get more and more adoption and people being willing to try things, because that to me is ultimately, you know, my contributions are only so much, but as a leader and a part of a team, it's really about what can the team accomplish. So I'm trying to figure out how I can get things in front of people that will help them advance in their journey.
So I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
So Copilot is built into Outlook, Word, PowerPoint, Excel, OneNote. I think that's all of them, isn't it? How are you finding that it performs across those? Do you feel like there's better use cases for certain applications over others? Obviously, I aired the feedback I've got on Copilot in Excel, mm-hmm. but is there like a go-to use case you have for Copilot that you think is really good at the moment that people either might not be aware of or that surprised you?
Well, one of the things that I think, and you know, just so your audience knows, like I don't work in Excel a lot, so I can't really comment on that. But where I am active is the two things that are interesting to me are in Word and PowerPoint, and sort of watching how things can go across those two is interesting. So I can take a Word document and say, you know, hey, start a PowerPoint for me, and I've been very impressed with kind of what it pulls together, and vice versa. Hey, here's a 50-page PowerPoint, summarize it for me in a Word document and those types of things. That has been impressive. And I think that probably wouldn't surprise people because those are, you know, when you think about the things that should work together. Now, what I haven't done really is to take OneNote and start to take things from OneNote and bring those in. But I think there should be a reasonable amount of productivity boost that will come as part of that. So those would be the things that specifically I would call out that have impressed me, that I think is some really interesting functionality that could have a significant impact on my productivity and productivity of others.
And I really love that you brought up that use case because you and I are totally aligned with that. I think right now the big advantage is that cross application connectivity that you've got. Yeah, because nobody wants to produce a long Word document and then have to start from scratch on a PowerPoint presentation when the information's already there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, likewise the other way around. It could be that the PowerPoint isn't detailed enough. So you say, look, using the PowerPoint as a framework, I want you to help me build this up in a Word document. You know, so I think in terms of efficiency gains and time saving, that is a mega use case. I mean, I find it quite funny when Copilot does the PowerPoint slides at the moment, you know, the images that it produces automatically. You know, it reminds me of the days of, you know, clip art, yeah. You know, days gone by. So of course you've got to switch them out, right? But I think in terms of structure, it's really good. And the other thing that I liked about Copilot in PowerPoint is I think there's a prompt that says, like, add a structure or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but it'll add subdividers for you in the presentation just to categorize your slides as you go through. And I thought that was quite a cool use case as well. So I'm glad you brought that up because that's probably my favorite use case as well.
Yeah. And, you know, when I think about the thing that I like about it is it moves me into editor mode as opposed to create mode. And what I find is that, you know, a lot of times, I'm sure a lot of people struggle with this, sort of sitting, staring at a blank screen, trying to create and get things, you know, get things going. But if I can just give it a couple of things and it throws something out there, I'm like, well, no, that's not what I was thinking. Instead, and then boom, I'm doing it because I'm in edit mode. I'm not in create mode. And I think, you know, I think as we see these things start to come to market, I think, you know, we'll learn a lot about ourselves in terms of, wow, I never really realized that I spent a lot of time struggling with that initial creation. And if I can just get something to give me three ideas, I'll pick the third and say, yeah, let's build on that, as opposed to just spending a lot of time just trying to get started. So I think there'll be a lot of things like that, that the tools will be great, but I think what we learn about how we use the tool is going to be really interesting.
Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned the staring at a blank page because I had the same conversation the other day. So I use ChatGPT GPTs because I think it's good to be able to sort of, you know, have a bot for a specific function, you know, just so that, you know, you've got like a couple of tabs open. You can say, oh, you know, I'm going to work with this bot because I know it's trained on this use case and I'm going to work with this bot over here, which is pretty cool. One of my bots is a content ideator. And it's trained with my knowledge, right? So we're going into creator mode rather than finance mode. I apologize. But I fed ChatGPT, one of the GPTs, my top 20% of LinkedIn posts in terms of performance. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's got an idea for the sort of topics I talk about, you know, what performs best. So it's got, you know, base knowledge. And then the GPT, when I give it a topic, will look at that knowledge and it will say, right, well, based on some of the stuff you've spoken about in the past, you know, here's some areas that you can go into that are relevant to your audience and so on and so forth. But the reason it makes me smile is I'll sometimes, you know, give it a prompt to say, you know, GPT content ideator, you know, give me some topic ideas on this subject. And it'll come back with some topics. And sometimes I don't use any of them. But because I've seen words on the screen, mm-hmm. I'm already started. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so quite often I'll go into a topic that doesn't relate in any way to the suggestion mm-hmm. that it's given me.
Because you've learned that that's not what you want, and that clears your mind for what you do want, which, you know, how long would it taken you have gotten there if you hadn't have used that tool? So great example.
Absolutely. And it's that, you know, sometimes just seeing some words connected just then gets something to fire in your brain that says, don't want any of that, but that's given me a really good idea for this. So sometimes just in terms of, as you say, getting that head start and getting the cogs whirring, you know, especially if it's first thing in the morning, you still yet to have a coffee, it can definitely speed up that process. But Dave, I've taken you too long. We've just hit the hour now. So for people that are listening and watching, where can people find out more about you? You know, can they connect with you? Take us through where you hang out.
Yeah, so a couple of things. First is connect with me on LinkedIn. So like Adam, not nearly as prolific, but I put hopefully thought-provoking things on LinkedIn. So it's linkedin.com/DaveHartley is where you can find me there. My firm is Anders CPAs and Advisors. We publish a ton of thought leadership that's out there and available. So follow us on socials there. And then also I co-host a podcast that we're in season 3 on, which is more of a business focused podcast, but it's called But Who's Counting. And that's available on all the major platforms. We're in season 3 now, which is focused on innovation. So we're talking with a lot of business leaders and executives about their innovation journeys and what they're doing to foster innovation in their companies. So there may be some things there that your listeners would find interesting.
I haven't got an invite yet.
It's on the way.
No, I'm winding you up, you know. Yeah. But no, the offer's there. But no, that's really good. I'll put all of that in the show notes, Dave, so people can check you out. I've had a look at some of the insights on the Anders CPA website, and they're great. Quite a broad range of topics, obviously, because you focus on a number of industries, mm-hmm. but there's a load of great stuff there. So I'll definitely put that in show notes as well. So, but no, appreciate you coming off. I'm sure we could speak for hours. Maybe we do a round 2 at some point in the future. But no, it's been an absolute pleasure, Dave. It's been a really good conversation.
Thanks, Adam. Really appreciate it. Hope your listeners can get something valuable from it.
Perfect. I'm sure they will. Cheers, Dave.
Thank you.
Hey again, and thanks for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard today, don't forget to like, review, and subscribe. And for more goodies, head over to techforfinance.com. See you soon.